Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, September 26, 2009. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. While the so-called leaders were impotently and immorally pontificating at the G20 summit in Pittsburgh this week, but while that was going on, the anger of the American people and their disgust with their so-called leaders has continued to build. Following the efforts of the Senate Finance Committee to ram through the Nazi precedent in the Baucus health care bill, and then the acknowledgement yesterday that the Federal Reserve has given corrupt and bankrupt bankers nearly $12 trillion, and at least that's what they admitted to, this mass strike process, as Lyndon LaRouche has characterized it, will deepen and will be increasingly drawn toward the leadership and the programmatic solutions offered by Lyndon LaRouche. In the first part of today's program, we'll be discussing this process with EIR's economics editor, John Hoeffel. In the second half of today's program, we're going to hear from two leaders of the LaRouche movement in Germany, where there will be a national election tomorrow. Elke Thimmen, a longtime representative of the LaRouche movement there, and Carsten Werner will give us the real story of the battle led by lead candidate Helga Zepp LaRouche to bring Europe out from under the control of the Anglo-Dutch-Saudi financial empire and into an alliance with the United States. And by the way, both Elke and Carsten are candidates in the election, which actually the voting is going to begin in just a few hours. So that will be a very interesting part of this discussion, and stay tuned for that in the second part. But we're going to begin with John Hoeffel. John is well known to listeners of the show from his poignant commentary on the complete idiocy of the current economic leadership in the United States. So, John, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Harley. My pleasure.
Let me begin with the report that came out, just to put the leading idiocy up front. The Group of 20 summit was just concluded in the city of Pittsburgh, which they're now saying is a good example for the future, and actually maybe they're right, because Pittsburgh is half the size that it used to be, and they want to reduce the world population by at least 50%. But in this communique, they praised what they call the largest and most coordinated fiscal and monetary stimulus ever undertaken, and they said it should continue until the global economy is restored to full health. Now, John, how crazy are these guys? This idea that we've talked about it before, but why? How can they say that there's a return to health in the economy?
It's easy. They're all accomplished liars.
Wow.
I mean, rather than rebut what they say, I think what I'd like to do is present what I see as the picture of what they're actually doing.
Yeah, please
all right?
Do.
Yes. Now, the G20 meeting is a tool of the British Empire. This is a meeting to implement and push forward policies of the empire, which have actually been decided elsewhere. And the key themes of this meeting are that, one, we're going to continue the bailout. Two, nations have to impose significant austerity on their own populations as a way of returning to fiscal health. And three, we have to have more global control, globalization. Now, you put all of those things together, and what you get is more power for the empire and the destruction of the nation state. And that's what's really going on here, that there is no attempt. The recovery talk is strictly for suckers. There is no intention at all of having a real recovery. This is the carrot and the stick, stringing people along while they implement a global fascist dictatorship. And that's what the G20 meeting is really part of. That's the process that's playing out there.
And it is fairly clear that this was agreed upon, as you said, before the meeting. There was the meeting 2 weeks ago in London where essentially Prime Minister Gordon Brown of Great Britain and Timothy Geithner, the Treasury Secretary of the United States, laid out the strategy of more bailout and more coordination. They called for the completion of the Doha round of the World Trade Organization during 2010. To what extent, John, I mean, I don't know whether we got much of a reading of this on the ground or not, But to what extent do countries such as India and China and Russia, which are part of the G20, just go along with this? Do they have another agenda, or are they, as far as you can tell, what's their relationship to this process?
Well, I think that at least from the standpoint of why you see the move from the G7 to the G20, and you see this talk about having these other nations have more of a say in what goes on, that is a trap. This is the way they're setting the trap for the global financial dictatorship. Because, I mean, let's get real. They don't want, the empire doesn't let nations have any say over the process. Mm-hmm. You know, because the decisions are not made by people like Tim Geithner and Ben Bernanke. They're doing what they're told, just like Obama is. That these meetings of these public officials, of the so-called national leaders, are really forums to discuss policies that have been implemented, that have been developed by people behind the scenes.
So you mean things such as the consolidation of the major banks, both in Great Britain and the United States, under the so-called stimulus bailout package?
Yes. That in no matter what happens, let's assume for a second, just go off into science fiction, that the empire actually pulls off this restructuring scheme it's planning. Now, you look at the size of the financial world, the size of the banking system that was needed at the height of the bubble to run the bubble. And then you look at the size of a banking system that would be needed if they win and successfully pare the world down to 2 billion people. And you can see that it's going to be a lot smaller. So there is all of this capacity, the great banking system of the bubble has to be taken down.
And we've already seen quite a bit of that with the loss of Wachovia, not much of a loss, actually, WaMu, some of these other banks, and what is it, 94? Or maybe I missed it. Maybe some more banks went under yesterday in the United States.
They might have. But you see the consolidation among the big ones and then the way the little ones are all being taken out. And this process is playing out nationally that you see, for example, that Morgan Chase, and Morgan is a British bank, make no mistake about it. It actually comes from Britain. That it's being touted as the healthy bank while Citigroup is being attacked because they're taking some of these giants and basically they're sucking them dry and they're going to leave the hulks of them for the government to bail out. You know, so they accomplish two things. One is that the oligarchy is stealing everything it can get its hands on. And the other is, then it's leaving the hulks for governments to bail out, which destroys the governments, as we see right now with our own hyperinflationary bailout. So, you know, we're being played for enormous suckers in this game. And people like Ben Bernanke and Larry Summers and Tim Geithner and Barack Obama, you know, how much of this they actually understand, I don't know. But it's irrelevant because basically they're active in an operation which is destroying the country.
And, John, one of the points that was made in a report I received from our European intelligence is that in their preamble they say financial markets are showing a willingness to invest and lend. This is, from all indications, this is just another blatant lie.
There is no financial market absent the bailout.
Yeah.
That the taxpayers' money and the money that the Fed is creating out of thin air is the market at this point.
Well, and you mentioned the Fed just then. I want to shift it into that question. But clearly, this is not going to quiet the anger that's been developing in the American people. I do a lot of organizing of the Ron Paul networks, the Tea Party networks, the Puma networks, a lot of different networks. And one of the things they've all coalesced around is an anger about the bailouts and a sharper focus on the Federal Reserve, the illegal, unconstitutional nature of the Federal Reserve. Now, yesterday there was a hearing on this, and as we were talking before, you said what was more important was what didn't come out than what came out. What actually came out in the discussion, and what are they covering up?
Well, it's clear that what they do not want under in any way, shape, or form is anybody looking into their books and their operations. No audits, no investigations, no nothing. Now, if they were published, you know, they publish all these statistics every week, including a balance sheet. And if this balance sheet was correct, what would they have to hide? Well, what they're hiding is the way in which they're distorting the whole economy around bailing out these giant financial institutions, basically bailing out the imperial system. The idea that, for example, that you can even measure the cost of the bailout in dollar terms is wrong, because you know what is the price tag that you would put on the destruction of the nation.
Mm-hmm.
So you know you've got a real problem with the way they approach this thing. But even in their own terms, you know, you've seen emails come out from the investigations run by Adolphus Towns, which show that the Fed is much more involved in the financial system than it likes to pretend, that it's
wrong. Well, let me just ask you this, because the Fed has been taking a role parallel with the Treasury in the bailouts. This goes back to the Paulson emergency plans back in September a year ago. But under the standard accepted charter of the Fed, isn't this something new, what they've been doing?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. I mean, the Fed and the banking system, they're much like the British Empire, which, you know, they don't have principles. They only have interest. Their only real principle is saving themselves. And so they're doing all sorts of things that, you know, are basically completely illegal.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can see that, you know, they are the market right now, and that's illegal, but they're doing it in conjunction with the government. The idea that the Fed is somehow independent, I mean, it's an interesting thing, because the Fed is clearly not acting in an independent way at the moment, except that it's acting in conjunction with the government. But then you have to say that the government is acting in conjunction with the people who run the Fed. You know, so they're both tools of the empire.
Right. In the statement Lyndon LaRouche put out this morning, which is up, or actually yesterday afternoon, it's up on our website under the headline LaRouche, Fed's actions are criminal, tantamount to treason. Congressmen who facilitate them should be prosecuted. And then I guess this morning he said, any congressman who does not or who blocks this audit should be impeached. With this bill, I've looked at the bill, and it's it is a pretty mild-mannered bill in the sense that it calls attention to the Fed, it calls for an audit. What do you think you said earlier that they don't want anyone to look into their books. Do you really think they have this stuff on their books, John?
Well, a competent investigation would catch that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, they probably have two sets of books, just like the banks that they are controlling have two sets of books. But you can't really hide a competent. See, if any audit should be done from the standpoint of a PCORA commission,
right,
to go in and find the criminal activity, not merely to look at their numbers, but to find the criminal activity and root it out. And the problem, what they fear, is not so much an audit, but that if people start looking into them, what will be discovered, it'll quickly become obvious that there's a whole lot more going on. And that's the real problem, because the Fed is not really an American institution. The Fed is an institution of this global financial empire.
Now, I saw in the hearing yesterday, Barney Frank, who's one of the most incompetent people and probably corrupt person in the Congress, that Frank is it was his committee that had the hearing, and he has endorsed the audit bill. But he's trying to incorporate it into the so-called financial regulatory reform legislation. Now, that regulatory reform legislation calls for the Fed to have an increasing role in regulation. Now, isn't there a problem here that on the one hand you're saying let's audit it, and then regardless of the audit, we're going to give them more power over the banking system?
Yeah, there is a problem, because this is not regulation, this is deregulation. And that's the pattern, the attempt that you're using the regulatory reform, so-called, is being used to further the consolidation. You look at, for example, they're talking about having banks have higher capital standards. Well, they're ignoring the capital standards they have already.
Great.
All right. So what are they really talking about? Well, I think that what they're really talking about is that this is how you shape which banks survive and which banks don't. You raise the capital standards, and then the banks that the empire favors, it floods with dope money and other things so that they have plenty of money, and they're the ones that survive. You know, that's the way this game is being played, that they're talking about regulating the derivatives market, but regulating the derivatives market in such a way as to give more power to a handful of players.
Well, in the G20 communique, they said that they would introduce a central clearinghouse on derivatives by 2012. So I'm not sure that I think it's fairly obvious this is not an attempt at regulation or criminal prosecution.
Yeah.
You're listening to The LaRouche Show. We're hearing now from John Hofel on both the insanity of the continued policies of the Anglo-Dutch Empire, and we're going to get into a moment into the opposition, the growing opposition. And then at the bottom of the hour, we're going to hear from Elke Thimmen and Karsten Werner on the extremely crucial elections that take place just hours from now in Germany. So, John, let's go back to something that what you said was very interesting, that the regulatory reform as presented by Summers and Geithner is really a further form of deregulation. Now, Lyndon LaRouche brought up again this week not just that we need to go back to the standards of Glass-Steagall, but this could be done fairly quickly. And we saw an interesting statement from Paul Volcker where he was, let's just say, leaning in that direction. What's your sense? I mean, has the Congress, are they pursuing this up to this point so far because of the mass strike ferment we saw at the end of the summer? And how important is the continuation of that ferment to actually having a possibility to implement the Glass-Steagall legislation?
Well, the ferment is continuing. It's a process which has a life of its own. And it is extremely important in us to put pressure on Congress, because the problem you have with Congress right now and with the administration, the presidency at large, is that there are people who want to do the right thing, but they're being blocked by a leadership that sits on every attempt to change things for the better. People like Nancy Pelosi and Barney Frank are perfect examples of the way this thing works, or Summers, you know, and Obama. But the mass strike is a reaction to the fact that the country is collapsing, that things are breaking down. And this breakdown is going to continue. As I said before, there is no recovery. The people who are saying that there's a recovery are lying. They know they're lying. They're restructuring the world, and they're just saying there's a recovery as a way of telling everybody to shut up and go back to sleep. And it's not going to work.
We saw more indication of that with the reports that came out this week that the banks are holding on to about 7 million homes that should be foreclosed, but they're not pushing them through. We see the unemployment. You know, the idea that the numbers of people who are losing their jobs is slightly smaller this week than last week, that's a recovery, is another example of this kind of sleight of hand.
Well, I'll go even further on that point and say that I think the labor figure, the employment figures, are just a lie, that they're at the point where they're just flat lying about this. It bears no relationship to what's actually going on. That's the case of much of the statistics that we see these days, that they're trying desperately to cover up the damage that is being done by this policy and try to pretend that there's a recovery, and they're putting out numbers that they're pulling, let's say, out of their hat, to be nice.
Well, if you look at a place like California, where there's been no figure recently, but the behind-the-scenes figure is that after all the cutting they've done so far, which is close to $60 billion, maybe close to $70 billion in a two-year budget, that there may still be another $8 to $10 billion that they're going to have to cut between now and the end of June 2010. The state of Pennsylvania still doesn't have a budget. There are 49 of the 50 states which, in order to get to a balanced budget, had to use the worst kind of accounting gimmickry and literally genocidal cuts, especially in health care. Now, here's another question that I got from a couple of people I was talking to last night on the health care bill, the so-called health care bill, where Obama says, don't worry, it'll be deficit neutral. It's not going to cost anything new. Now, put aside that for a moment. How do they think they can cover $12 trillion to $25 trillion in blowing up this new debt by the Fed and the Treasury with cutting health care? I mean, even if they slash health care to the bone, they're not going to make the savings that they have to. So where do they go from here? You talked about austerity. What do you see coming up if these guys are able to get their policies through?
Well, I think what they're talking about with health care and just, you know, basically killing people, this is the model that they're going to savagely cut services, because the goal of the empire is to bring down the United States. So we're going to have tremendous austerity here. Our standard of living has to take a giant hit because we consume too much, you know, and all this other nonsense. And there's a concerted effort. If you read the British press, is a very good example of how there now is this very open statement by public officials and by the press that basically we have to have savage austerity, that the question is how much can we cut? And that's the debate that's going to happen here in the United States. This health care bill is the foot in the door, because the health care is a big expense. And once you start killing off the old people, then, you know, you solve a lot of the Social Security and Medicare and other problems.
And that's why Lyndon LaRouche has insisted that the precedent is not merely rationing, but actually the open commitment to mass genocide that was implemented with the T4 policy in Germany under Hitler, what the Nuremberg Tribunal said was the beginning of the mass genocide, that is exactly the model that there is for the Obama administration. And not surprisingly, it's a model that was invented in Britain and imposed in Germany under Hitler. And now it's British networks that are doing the same thing with the Obama administration.
Yeah, and the role of the behaviorist crowd in the Obama administration is to try to convince us all that this savage austerity is good for us because it's green. That, you know, you don't drive a car, you don't eat meat, you don't have an air conditioner in the summer, you don't have heat in the winter, but it's all good for you because it's green.
Well, and this is why we're seeing a mass strike phenomenon. I just got a report right before we went on the air from LaRouche Youth Movement leader Nick Walsh out here in Los Angeles. There's a town meeting today, a Republican congressman, Buck McKeon, and there were over 1,000 people there. So for those people who say it's died out, forget it. It hasn't. Many people in the crowd were shouting and angry because McKeon gave a detailed analysis of the health care bill. And people were asking, what about this, what about that? And he gave these details. Finally, Nick stood up and he said, look, we don't need to go through the details. This bill should be crushed. And the audience erupted in wild cheering. And then he said the reason that there's been all this action in August at the town meetings is the American people don't want this bill. Again, cheering. And then Nick said the Obama and his administration want to kill people. Now, that was a little more controversial. There was a little less cheering, but there was a lot of cheering. And then Nick said, look, the congressman said, what's your question? And Nick said, well, if you're serious about doing something, how about shutting down the Federal Reserve? And that led to wild, enthusiastic applause. So I think from this standpoint, you look at what we face now. You look at the deficits. You look at the debt. You look at the collapse. And John, you mentioned the labor figures being fraudulent. You can just see it in terms of California. The number of manufacturing jobs in California 15 years ago, manufacturing was 20% of all the jobs in the state. Today, the total job numbers have collapsed, and total manufacturing is now only 10%, and that includes computer chips. So just to wrap this section up, the Doha round is targeting now food production, but we're already seeing a great diminution of farmers and agricultural production in the United States. What are we supposed to produce, John, in the future? Assuming they have some strategy, what is this model that they're talking about?
Soylent Green.
You're going to have to explain that because I think some of our listeners don't know that movie.
All right. There was a movie called Soylent Green. And basically, it was talking about an Obama-like healthcare plan where you have these euthanasia clinics and, you know, they euthanize the old people and the sick. And then they take the bodies away and ship them off to a factory where they turn them into food chips that they call Soylent Green. And I think that's what we're going to be producing in the future if we continue down this path.
Now, where do you see this bill going in the Congress? Because clearly with Barney Frank supporting it, he's going to try and head it off. Ron Paul has continued to keep it somewhat limited only to an audit. But we're coming to a head. What do you think is going to happen with this?
I think they're going to keep doing everything they can do, Barney Frank and Pelosi et al., to stop this thing. Whether or not the people in the House who were supporters of this bill are going to break with the leadership on this question and force this through or not, I think remains to be seen. But I would also say that either way, I think that it's largely irrelevant because as this financial system continues to collapse, as the country continues to break down, the mass strike is going to grow to the point where it's going to become an unstoppable force in and of itself. And that all of the plans that these congressmen have, even the good ones, are going to get swept away by something that they never imagined could happen.
And, John, you were on with Lyndon LaRouche this morning when he did his weekly discussion with the leadership. What were his marching orders?
Fight. Go out and don't pull your punches. This is a Nazi policy, the healthcare policy, that this administration is implementing fascist policies, that there is no recovery, that we have to go out and say these things, and we have to say them very clearly, and that we never pull our punches, we never back off, we know we're right, and that not only we, but all of the people who support us and are part of the larger movement have to do the same thing. Keep pushing. We're telling the truth. Events are going to bear this thing out, especially as we head into October, in which we could see the complete disintegration of the system. And at the point in which this thing starts to come down, we have to be prepared to make our move and to force the policy changes that we need pushed through. So we have to fight like hell over the next month.
And John, just for our listeners, are you going to have an article this week that will be up on the website on any of this?
Yeah, I wrote something on the coming into October, what it looks like, you know, the collapse of that. This is really the collapse of the British system, the collapse of globalization, and that what they're trying to save is the part that should be thrown away.
And is that up on the LaRouche PAC website?
I don't know.
All right. Well, we'll have to get it up there because this would be filling out the picture that was identified earlier in the week by Lyndon LaRouche. In his he wrote a couple of statements on the fuse is lit, that we're already into this October crash, and his discussion of what he means, he's basically telling people, don't try and interpret what I'm saying. Don't watch for bank buildings to fall. We're in a crash, and the only question is at what point the implosion occurs. And he's really talking about things like banks not functioning, no food at grocery stores. I mean, that's what he's talking about when he talks about this crash.
Absolutely. Absolutely, that the society itself is going to break down if we keep going down this road, that there will be no money available for anything, but the real issue is not money, it's the physical economy.
Right.
And when that shuts down, I mean, you know, what's your average lifespan in a city if the delivery of groceries to the city gets cut off?
All right, well, you can look for the article from John Hofel in the on the LaRouche PAC website. And John has something posted just about every week. John, thanks for joining us today. And I think the words you gave us from Lyndon LaRouche are the right ones. You never step back. The success we've had has been because we have pushed, even when some of our own members were reluctant to do so.
Absolutely.
So thank you, John.
Sure.
Now we're going to, it's not even change direction or shift gears, because we're taking up the same process as it's hitting on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean. Helga Zepp LaRouche said this week that the election that will be taking place on Sunday, September 27th, in Germany, is one of the most important elections in German history. So we're going to be talking now with Elke Fimmen, who is a candidate in the elections and a longtime associate of Lyndon and Helga Zepp LaRouche, and also with Carsten Werner, who is also a candidate. Elke, let me start with you. Why is this election so important? What's at stake in this election?
Well, I think it's really not different from what we heard so far in terms of the breakdown of the physical economy and in terms of the crash of the financial system in which we are at this point, because Germany, contrary to some people here in this country who might still think that this is not so, Germany is not an island of those who can be happy and who don't have any problems. But let me say that I think in this campaign, which we now did with the Büso for the federal election campaign, we really accomplished something very, very important. And that is that I think we positioned ourselves for the coming crash and for the coming shock, let's better say, because we are already in the middle of this crash. Because nobody really here in Germany of these politicians which are running, so you could also ask where they are running or where they are running from,
right.
But nobody dare to address the dimension and the dynamic of the situation, and of course nobody presented a solution. So that was the thing I think which became very, very clear to many of the people who had a chance to meet the Büso, who had a chance to see us and to get into a dialogue, that what we are saying and in particular what Helga Zepp LaRouche has been saying is a complete different view on the situation and is also the only serious approach to it.
We hear from some of the politicians there, certainly Merkel at the G20 was in line with what Gordon Brown and Obama said about the recovery. We have to be very careful to not harm the recovery. But do these delusions exist within the population, or are you finding a lot of response when we say, look, it's not recovering, we're just beginning to see the depth of the crash?
Well, I think the gap between what these politicians have been trying to tell people and the sense of the looming reality is becoming ever wider, and people don't buy it anymore. So I just saw today in the news that Merkel said something to the effect about the Pittsburgh meeting that what was accomplished is that never again banks can put pressure on countries or on nations, which I find quite incredible, especially in view of what John just told us before. So it's really the exact opposite. So there is this effort to somehow try to, you know, keep some kind of normality, to tell the people, look, we are going to solve everything for you. Everything will be nice. Everything will be fine. Don't worry. But what is developing is a sense, I think, it's not yet completely there, but it's a sense of the population which really knows that these politicians don't have an answer and are really trying to just lull them in. So, Merkel had this...
And I think there's also, you have something very similar in Germany to the United States of lying statistics, because I think... From what I've been reading, there's been a major loss of manufacturing jobs,
right.
Productive jobs, a collapse
right.
of exports. How bad is the situation in terms of employment now in Germany, and is it worse in the East than the West?
Well, yeah, it is worse. But if you just look at some of the figures, it's really very, very bad. We have the biggest exports collapse in the first half year ever. For Germany, it collapsed, if you compare it to last year, by almost 25%, especially into the EU countries, which is the most important export countries for Germany, but also to Russia, to other places, to Turkey, to India, and so on. Also, the German imports collapsed which, you know, gives you a sense of that we are in the middle of a collapse of world production and of world trade, because Germany used to be the export champion. And so then you have a situation just for 1 month, in the month of July, the industry, the people who are working in industry were down by 200,000 jobs. That is, this is just in average, but the general was, I mean, was much, much worse in various sectors. It was in metal producing, auto, machine building. So this is all collapsing. And the only thing which, in a sense, held it up so far, the impression that it's not really that bad, this is bad already, but the only thing is the fact that we have here in Germany this instrument of the short work, where, you know, people are not really laid off, but they don't work for a certain period of time. And this is the figure right now, up to more than 1.4 million jobs which are in this short work. And this is expected to then turn into layoffs very, very quickly, because it's clear that, the whole thing will not become better. And that, in turn, of course, means that people pay less in terms of the taxes for the social systems. And now you have a development which is really this chain reaction into the physical economy, where the corporate tax is just collapsing, which mainly goes to the municipalities and to the states. And even now in formerly very rich areas like the south of Germany, Bavaria and Baden-Württemberg, which is the Stuttgart area, for people who want to have some orientation, there the corporate tax are really collapsing. In Bavaria, it was in the first half year by minus 15%. So cities have, this is average, you know, so cities really have to cut back on what they provide for their citizens. Then the municipalities have to pay much more for those people who are becoming unemployed, and so on and so on. People earn less.
That's so very similar.
Exactly. No, the reason why I'm saying this is because this is like, you know, this is like the time bomb which is looming after after tomorrow, where everybody knows that this is not going to become better. And there's the auto problem with Opel, with Mercedes. Mercedes, the, you know, they have now 41,000 workers on short work, and this is really, I mean, these are for a country like Germany, this is really, these are huge developments. So this is the reality of the situation which people sense, and they don't really believe in what these politicians are telling them. So therefore, I would just stress that through the campaign of the Büso, and in particular of Helga, we have shown, I think, a real way out for people to orient to, so that they know that there is another program. And let me just say this in conclusion for your question. Sometimes in this campaign, I think the organizers had certainly the feeling, or, you know, the impression that that you are running there like a giant among all these Lilliputians, these dwarfs of these other politicians, and of course the media try to put you down, you know. But it's something which is very, very clear, and I think will become much more clear for the population.
Well, the process you were describing about the state governments and local municipalities is exactly what happened, what's been happening in the United States. And I understand that Berlin as a city is completely bankrupt. But one more question for you, Elke, and then I want to turn to Karsten. I had seen a report that I guess it's Steinmeier is the main candidate of the so-called opposition, but I think we were referring to the two candidates as Steinmerkel. But is there anybody besides the Büso? And for those who don't know, Büso is the party of Helga Zepp-LaRouche, and that's the political party that the LaRouche candidates are running on that ticket in Germany. But what about Linkspartei? What about, I mean, is everybody pretty much echoing the same thing? No solutions outside of what we have?
Yeah, that, I think that can be fairly said, because the Linkspartei, they are populistic, you know. They point out that this is all no good, what is being done, and that the population should, there should be no, more social justice. But they are against nuclear power, they are against real industrial jobs. You know, it's something to lure people into some kind of the idea that you protest against the establishment because the Linkspartei is not in the government. But I think this also will not hold. The problem, however, is that there is going to be a certain massive increase of radicalization in this coming period. So this is what these people like Linkspartei are counting on. But, I think the crucial thing really is what we did in this campaign. You know, we put out more mm-hmm. than 500,000 pamphlets, leaflets, we had the webcasts, we had DVDs, we had all sorts of interventions, and we accomplished to a certain extent a certain kind of breakthroughs locally in terms mm-hmm. of the media. But I think the situation is going to change very, very quickly, and we have positioned ourselves in an absolute excellent way to go from here. And as Helga said, you know, the campaign definitely is not going to stop tomorrow, but we are just going to take off.
Well, let me turn to Carsten Werner, who I believe you're a candidate in Leipzig. Is that what you said, Carsten?
Yes.
And what did you do as part of your campaign? Elke gave us a picture of a very large-scale distribution of literature. I think Helga had three webcasts. What were we doing as candidates in this campaign?
Yeah, I would like to stress, actually, that the webcast, that is a format to present yourself as a candidate that just most other candidates that we've just been mentioning are just not fit for. What are they doing standing there for an hour? They won't have the issues to talk about. They don't have the competence to talk about any of the crucial issues facing this nation. So, and since Mrs. Zeppler-Rusch has now been giving three webcasts, this has really put her on the spot in a way that has not been done before, because there's an internet audience. You can use this ever-growing medium as a thing to spread her campaign, which wasn't possible before. And since we have a media dictatorship, it's always hard to get through there, even though we have a little bit of reports. What the candidates have been doing in the local districts is we've been singing a lot, because our idea was to bring politics to the people. Since we have this crazy situation of the government not doing anything for the people, most people have been losing hope, have been losing confidence in the government at all, which results in a high percentage of people not voting, which is almost sometimes even the majority of people not voting. So you ask who actually has elected this government. So what we did, for example, is we took a chorus, we took a group of people, let's say a dozen of young people, of our activists, and just went to the poor areas of certain cities that we're running candidates in and go directly to the houses of people, to the flats. And we're standing down in front of the balconies. We've been giving a briefing with a megaphone. Then people come out on the balconies, then we sing something. And this has been something that is quite amazing here, because people might be familiar with, you know, all the German classical poets, composers, and so mm-hmm. on and so forth. But it's mostly forgotten here. People still know the names. But when you bring this out to people, when you do sing, for example, Schiller's Ode to Joy, set to music by Beethoven, it really has a ring with people. People's faces lit up, they start to sing along, because all of a sudden they get a sense of, wow, this is part of me. This is who I really am. And this
exactly.
is, it also connects them as a people. And I think that sense is actually now being aroused in the American population, where they say, well, hold on a minute. We're the people. We're keeping this thing up here, this country. We're the working people. So what the hell are these people doing up in Washington, D.C., or in this case, in Berlin?
Well, I saw the same thing last week in Boston. I was in Boston for a town meeting, and there were some people there from the Tea Party groups. And the chorus opened by singing a cappella version of the American National Anthem, the Star-Spangled Banner, which was beautiful. But it was... you know, the words were clear, but it was something different than what you hear at a ball game or something because of the way it was sung. It was sung bel canto. And I could see the effect in the audience. Now, I was wondering, Carsten, to what extent has this mass strike process in the United States been covered in the press in Germany? I know that a lot of the European press was so glad to get rid of Bush and Cheney that they bought into the idea of Obama as the Messiah. Is this starting to change? Is there coverage of the opposition to the health bill and certain other things? What are you getting on that?
Well, the picture of Obama is slowly coming here, as usual. people might have heard on this show or otherwhere that a part of Germany, former East Germany, Dresden, was called this, the Valley of the Clueless, because they didn't have cable TV access. So they could only watch East German TV instead of West German TV, so they were cut off from the real world, so to say. But the problem today is that most of Europe is now the Valley of the Clueless. So, for example, this big demo happening in the middle of the September in Washington, D.C., which I understand had a few hundred thousand people, was only covered as a demonstration with a few tens of thousands. And it's not being portrayed as a real upheaval of all American citizens, as citizens, not as some, you know, local interest group or right-wing extremists, which is a lot of what you hear also against the healthcare bill. They do cover that. There was a period 2, 3, 4, 5 days in a row where they even have shown LPEG organizers in German television saying this is a Nazi euthanasia bill, but always putting that in the context of, you know, right-wing extremists just trying to attack Obama. But what you do have to, what we are seeing on the streets with normal people we talk to, is they do get a sense now it would be slowly time for Obama to finally do something. You know, they've been hoping and hoping and hoping. Well, he's, you know, he's young, he's charismatic, first black guy to be president, wonderful. But so what's coming? You know, and there's nothing coming, and so they do see that if you tell him, look, he's given more money to the banks, he's sending more people to Afghanistan, which is also a hot issue here in Germany since we also have right. soldiers there, and so on and so forth, people admit, well, yeah, I guess you're right, so what are you doing?
Well, I think this is something that we should work to develop, is this idea of bringing. I think this is part of your idea in the campaign. I think Helga talked about this in her second webcast, bringing the mass strike to Germany. So that's part of what you're describing with the singing, the door-to-door campaigning. Clearly, you're beginning to see a potential sleeping giant, namely the German people, start to wake up.
Yeah, I mean, we made a picket which has a very, it's very simple. It just has a picture of the demonstrations in 1989 in Germany, and it says Germany 1989, and then it shows a picture from the Washington D.C. rally and says USA 2009. So people come up and say, "What is this?" You know, but there's a lot of interest if people hear about that stuff is going on. And yes, Helga has been talking about this extensively in her second webcast. Has used a lot of footage, so people can actually see this stuff since it's not being covered in the media.
Let me maybe just say on this that what you see also, which I think is really important, is that this former belief in the media is also really breaking apart. Before, I mean, a couple of, I don't know, months ago or so, people were still sort of credulous. You know, they thought, yeah, maybe it's all not that bad, and people really try to get, the politicians try to get us out of this mess and so on. But this hate against the media and the mistrust against the media, this has really increased in a quite strong way. And this, I think, is part of this, you know, gap which is now developing between what people think what might become real or what is real, and what the TV tells them and what the politicians tell them.
Now, I have a couple specific questions that I think would be of great interest to the listeners in the United States. You're listening to The LaRouche Show, and we're now talking with Elke Thimmen and Carsten Werner, who are both candidates of the BUSO, the LaRouche Party in Germany. And they're discussing the situation both politically and economically there. Elke, let me ask you on the, you know, we just saw the 20th anniversary. We're actually in the middle of the 20th anniversary of the fall of the DDR, the hated East German regime, which occurred very rapidly. To what extent do people have a sense that right after it happened, Helga said, we can't miss this opportunity. And then I think maybe 8 years ago, she wrote something on lost opportunity of 1989. To what extent do you get a reflection of that in Germany, that there was a moment where something big could have happened? And as we know now, because of Thatcher and Mitterrand and the stupidity of George Herbert Walker Bush, that moment was lost. Is that something that resonates among the people in Germany?
Well, I think it resonates mostly, maybe I'm wrong, but maybe Carsten can say something more about it. I think it resonates mostly with the people in East Germany, because they have a sense that something went really wrong because of the situation in which they are now. So they, because the of the high unemployment because of the whole deindustrialization, the shock therapy which was imposed after 89, and all these kind of things. So I think this feeling is very strong in the East. But in general, I have held quite some election meetings now, and in the discussion with people, when you refer to and you reflect on the current situation and you say, look, I mean, if you think about it, you know, 20 years ago, a system collapsed of which none of us who were older enough at that time had ever thought that it might collapse. And so if you put it in this in the current situation, in this historical reflection, then people suddenly get a sense of, yeah, it's true, something happened back then, this thing can collapse. And I reminded people that Helga at that point also told people that told politicians, told the population, because we intervened in a massive way into the when the wall came down with leaflets and everything. That she had told at that point that this is a gigantic opportunity of mankind, that we have mm-hmm. to use it, that now it's the time to put the ideas of freedom finally into practice. And she had called above all also for a big cultural renaissance as a basis for the economic development, which then she had laid out with the concept of the productive triangle, using the area of Berlin, Paris, Vienna as the economic motor of development for the whole of the East, which had been really eluded. So this kind of reflection, if you bring it up now, together with what you referred to on these documents which just came out, that basically mm-hmm. Thatcher and Mitterrand really made a big point to try to prevent reunification. So if you bring this in, and also the fact that the euro and Maastricht was then imposed on Germany, right. to destroy it, and people know by now that the euro, Maastricht, all this crazy supranational scheme was just another phase of globalization and of looting. So right. therefore, you get a sense of historical continuity, which people normally have lost through this brainwashing, since they don't know anything about history.
Well, so, I noticed also that there was some coverage of our candidates, which brought up the land bridge, and that obviously right. is a reflection of what we were doing, because we were very visible in the right. period after the fall of East Germany and the Soviet Union. We were very visible. Helga was the Silk Road lady. She was the one who was putting this forward. So these ideas are still there.
Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. And as I said, in this historical dynamic now, which is developing, you know, if you put these things together, these events, which are then not only events, but you know, you show what is the continuity, what is the discontinuity, and where we are now, and that this was a political decision to sabotage the golden opportunity of 89 by the euro, by Maastricht, by this British geopolitics. Then people get a sense that also today you can act politically. And then if you then bring in the fight in the United States and the mass strike there, which we have to connect up with, you know, then it's a completely different picture, which gives people hope. And mm-hmm. I would really like to stress that you know, how you, when you talk here about our program, we stress a lot, of course, the question of the credit system, of the national sovereignty, and always referring to the Kreditanstalt Wiederaufbau, which was a copy, basically, or not a copy, but after the example of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation of Roosevelt.
Right.
You know,
right.
this kind of mechanism that you can do this, that you can get the economy going again, and then you get the idea of that people get an idea that there can be something done in an international concert, especially with the United States. And as Carsten already mentioned before, people are really looking to the U.S. for a change, because people here are not so naive to think that Germany alone or Europe could get out of this crisis.
Well, let me bring up, and I'll ask you this, Carsten. One of the striking features of Helga Zepp-LaRouche's last webcast was the story she presented on Chancellor Bismarck and the adoption of an American system policy. And what struck me was that in the brainwashing, including, and Helga talked about this in Germany, that people don't know the story, but in the United States, the idea, what we've been taught, is that nationalism in Germany, that the assertion of national sovereignty in Germany, is what Hitler was, that the Nazis were ultra-nationalists, and any kind of nationalism could lead to a return to Nazism. Of course, that's what Thatcher's idea of the Fourth Reich was, so that you had to prevent that. How much of a bombshell was Helge's discussion of Bismarck? I mean, have you picked up discussions with people on this, and what do you think the effect of this is going to be, Karsten?
Well, you just said it. I think it was a real bomb that has been dropped, because it's the same here in the education, that people know that Bismarck was the one who unified Germany for the first time out of feudalism into at least one Reich, into one nation, and that he also instituted a social policy which was then a role model for the whole world, first healthcare system for the people. And then also, obviously, the industrial policy. People do know that he did that, but they don't know how he did it. And it's funny, if you look at today's discussion, now we had this G20 meeting, what is so, you know, shocking to me is that the basic fundamental ideologies, globalization, free market economy, have not been even touched. You only talk about small details that you want to regulate or change. But you always have attacks on this heretical idea of protectionism. Right. In every speech by Merkel or politicians, you always find this little attack on protectionism. Nobody really knows what it is. But that was a question which was hotly debated during Bismarck's time. And the funny thing is, he's very honest. We dug out a parliamentary session with him speaking in the Reichstag then, in, I believe it was 1882, where he said, well, I didn't know a lot about these things because somebody else was dealing with this, but then this minister left the position and I had to do his job. And then I found out that the whole free trade system was crap, it's wrong. And then I found out that what the British had been doing, which were obviously the empire at that time, is they had protective tariffs to protect their nation against cheap imports from other countries, to protect their own manufacturers. And then when they were strong enough, then they just swamped everybody else with their cheap products. And nobody was allowed to, you know, build up their own manufacturers, which is basically, it's a little bit different today, but it's basically the same thing today, that no nation is allowed to protect their own sovereign right to protect their people with food security, energy security. It's all based on this globalization. And Bismarck is very explicit, and Helga gave detailed quotes by him, and everybody should watch his webcast. It's archived also in English on the website, what exactly he said. But he just made the point that, you know, looking at America in that speech I just already mentioned, you'll find that America has grown to very rich wealth under this protectionist system, under a system which cares for the American people and for the American people alone, which, you know, implicitly also says that we're not making policy for these financial speculators. Something he also says, which I think is just paradigmatic for the way we as the Büsse are campaigning here today, is that I'm not making policies for the next elections. If I would have limited myself or be afraid of what the result in the next election is, I wouldn't have gone into politics. So I think that is really the spirit we have to have today, that we have a long-term perspective and know what's right, what works for a nation. And people just said, watch that speech, because it has a lot of depth. It's Bismarck, it's his closest advisor, Kardorff, was an economic advisor of Bismarck, who wrote a paper that was actually called Proposal for the German Trade Policy According to Carey's, Henry Carey's proposals, was right. The advisor of Lincoln, naturally. And then
Carsten, we're running out of time, and I want to emphasize this point that people should listen to what Helge Zeppler-Ruch said, and also some of the preliminary work that was done in the United States was in the documentary 1932, which the LaRouche Youth Movement did in the United States, which incorporated showed how Bismarck's actions in the late 1870s were a result of his study of what happened with the Lincoln Revolution in the United States. And it was precisely for this reason that ultimately the British forced Bismarck out of power as a precondition for launching the First World War. So this is, I think, extremely important. We just have about a minute left. Elke, I'd like to ask you, what do you think is going to happen with the vote tomorrow? Clearly, we made a huge impact. What do you think is going to be the effect, though?
Well, I think the most important effect is that Helga came out as a giant, both morally and intellectually, in contrast to all these other dwarves. And that is what people can orient to, and that, I think, is an extremely important result of this election.
Right. I would agree from what I've seen, absolutely, and it points to the future that we've got to bring this mass strike process, keep it flowing in the United States and develop on this gap that exists between where the people are and the lies of the leadership in Europe as well. Carsten and Elke, thank you very much for joining us today on The LaRouche Show. This has been our weekly edition of The LaRouche Show. It's going to be up on the LaRouchePub.com website, so you can get your friends to listen to it, and we will be back next Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time for the next edition of The LaRouche Show. Thanks for joining us today.